My name is Angie Brown, and you are listening to the Being Luminary podcast, the podcast where I get into all things diversity, equity, and inclusion with luminary guests, a sprinkling of coaching, advice, guidance, and the inspiration for you to do things differently in your organization. If you want to create a luminary place to work, a luminary experience for your clients, your teams, your communities, if you are committed to overleaping compliance and heading straight for luminary approaches to DEI, you are in the right place. You are listening to the Being Luminary podcast, episode number 77. Welcome back to the Being Luminary podcast, where we are in a special series featuring conversations from our November 2023 virtual summit, Reimagining DEI for a New Era of Ethical Leadership. In these conversations, you are going to hear me talking to my guests, thought leaders, educators, innovators in the field of diversity, equity, and inclusion. Each window is going to be a bit of a window into our conversation, but also some of the ideas and strategies that we really feel are shaping the future of DEI. I hope you enjoy. I'm really pleased to be in conversation for this session with David Bedrick. And David, would you like to introduce yourself to this audience of summit gatherers?
Sure. Introductions are always interesting because there's like the more like the credentials. This is what I've studied and written. Mm. And then there's the personal credentials, what a person, me in this case, have been through and wrestled with and made something out of. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So on the former side, I started an institute. It's called the Santa Fe Institute for Shame-Based Studies. So I'm interested in shame in a very specific definition, which maybe we'll talk about how shame operates in different ways. In this case, in terms of the issues of diversity, how shame manifests in that area. Mm. I'm working on a fourth book. My second book is maybe fitting here. It's called Revisioning Activism. So it's about social justice, injustice, and psychology's role or lack of role in addressing issues of what I would call diversity and injustice. I'm working on a book now called Unshamed for North Atlantic Books. And that just fitting our topic, there's a number of sections on internalized oppression and social issues and injustice and what that has to do with shame.
I'm a coach as well as a diversity, equity, inclusion consultant. And so I worked with lots of people who felt they held similar identities to me. And so they were people who were going into leadership. They were often Black women. They were often Black women who were also single parents and wondering, you did it, Angie, how do I do this? And one of the things that I noticed when I talked to these women often was that there were really unreliable witnesses to their experience around them. So they would come up with all of this, I'm just not this enough, I can't seem to understand, there's something, I'm not working this out. And there was always a tension for me around coaching those people, because actually the witness has been so unreliable, and the witness being often the institution, that it's gaslit them into thinking something about themselves, which just is pure fabrication. So at the point of meeting obvious institutional injustice, how do you work with that? You know, how do you unshame in that context? Yeah. Do you see what I'm getting at?
I see exactly what you're getting at. Yeah. The great African-American scholar, W.E.B. Du Bois, he coined the phrase double consciousness. Mm. He said, inside, and he was speaking about African-Americans, Black Americans, he said, inside is a consciousness, is two consciousnesses. One of them is a white-oriented, white-biased consciousness. And then the Black person internalizes that. So they're looking at themselves through eyes that are saying, well, this is not pretty hair. Well, yeah. Those are hurtful statements. Yeah. Where did that come from?
Yeah.
I didn't grow, it wasn't in my DNA. Where did it come from?
Yeah.
My nose shouldn't be, my hip shouldn't be this way, et cetera. Yeah. Skin pigmentation all around the world. Skin pigmentation is a huge issue. Where does that come from? So Du Bois says, it's a consciousness that we internalize. I don't know if he used that word, but that's exactly what he meant. Mm-hmm. So it's a big thing. So what do you do about that? There's different levels. At one level, people need to talk about internalized oppression more.
Yeah.
This is what's inside of me. Mm-hmm. When I talk at a certain pace with my hands moving and fast and my brightness comes out, I get frightened. Mm-hmm. For me, that's connected to my Jewish history. I feel like I'm outed and I'm scared. Mm-hmm. And that lives in my traumatic bones and stories and generational history. I didn't know that at first. How come I'm teaching a university class and I'm shaking when I go home? Frightened, like terrified. Yeah. So something inside of me is looking at me, maybe out in the world also, but now it's inside. And I think, why can't I calm down? I should sit more carefully. I should not move around so much. That looks like a better way of being. So I've internalized that way of being.
Mm.
People need to talk about those inner experiences more across all kinds of groups so that people get used to, oh, that's what's going on when I look in the mirror. This is what I'm thinking. This is why I'm thinking I shouldn't be upset. I shouldn't be agitated. This is why I learned I should forgive even when I'm being hurt.
Yeah.
So those messages need to be talked about, the witnessing messages. There's a violence. I'm thinking about Dylan Roof, I think is the name. I might be getting that wrong. Teenage, 19-year-old white male goes into a Black church and shoots. This is so triggering. I just wanted to say to everybody, talking about these as just actual stories, they're feeling experiences, you know?
Mm.
So he shoots 9 people, Black people, kills them. Fucking hell. See, this makes me want to scream, and it's good to want to scream, right? Otherwise, what's telling me I should be calm and reasonable? This is unreasonable, right? Reason shouldn't capture this. We need now we need people around who are having feeling experiences so we don't create an atmosphere that looks like we should be not grieving, not in tears, not triggering memories, not in rage, right? We shouldn't dismiss those. Otherwise, we create, I call that a shaming atmosphere. Okay, so everybody, let's talk about this. And now it looks like this is a good way to be.
Yeah.
It's not a good or bad way to be. It's one way to be.
Yeah.
But it marginalizes the body's feeling experience, right? The hair on my arm is going up.
Yeah.
I want to weep.
And I'm just thinking, as you're talking, I'm thinking about my, and I don't know, I hope this is helpful to the people who are watching this, that I'm really aware of the need to be impassive in when people are talking about racial violence. Like internalized stuff for me is around be impassive, don't show any emotion about this. Don't have any, you know, don't let people think that you're moved by this or stirred by this, because that's not going to be the way to solve this. You know, your responsibility is to be calm, keep it down, calm down.
Amazing.
So interesting to me is how I ever even access that. How, you know, because until we're having this conversation, I'm not even aware that that's a thing that I necessarily do in the face of those things.
Right.
And often when I work with people, I'll say, you know, how does that feel? And they'll tell me how they think. And I always think I'm so clever because I'm like, I can access my feelings, but I'm so aware of the way that I control and manipulate my feeling, but my actual body to be in certain spaces so that my body doesn't impact upon another body in a way that I think is unseemly.
Deep.
How does one begin?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, being in groups is really helpful where people are gonna be invited to feel and express, and where the group can make a kind of a safety. Safety to me means no one is going to try to suppress another person unless they're going to hurt another person. Like, you know, you don't want anybody to like smash somebody. I get that.
Yeah.
But where people can feel and show feeling, where people can kind of get used to, that's what it looks like. That's the rage. Then people can sometimes go, oh, that rage lives in me. I know it because it affects me so much, but I don't know because I've never seen it inside myself. And then we could do what we were suggesting before. You could go into the body. So what are you feeling, Angie? Where are your feelings living? Oh, they're living in my hands, in my feet, in my belly, in my eyes. Can you connect with those? Spend a few minutes, even 2 minutes, with those feelings and show it with your hands, with a sound. What's the sound of what's going on in your chest and belly? And then other people around you will witness it, but you will witness it. Like if you have a person who says, I'm scared, and you say, can I make the sound of your fear? Like if I say, I'm really scared, Angie, the difference between that and if I said, if you say, can you show me the sound of your fear? Like already that's going to impact you and me. I kind of go, oh. I even just now I heard myself do that. Like, I think I have that inside of me. So even I don't witness it. I don't know it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there's a sort of personal commitment to that I'm really interested in, like doing the work in that personal realm. But there's also the institutional unshaming, and this is often where I work, and I talk about, we do this work with no guilt, no blame, no shame, and it sounds a bit easy and pithy, but actually there's something of meaning there for me that we're not going to get anywhere until we can really excavate what the heck is going on about what we think should be going on and what we think shouldn't be going on and what we think we shouldn't be saying and hearing and all of those things. How at an institutional level, when, sorry, this is a very long question, but at an institutional level where we're dealing with things like cancel culture or the litigious nature even of how we've gone about this work in the past or we want to go about it in the future. How can we ever really bring unshaming to at an institutional level? Because I work with so many leaders who are like, if I say that I'm carrying homophobia, if I say that I'm a witness to my own ableism, I'm a witness to my own anti-Semitism, then what happens to me out there in the world? If I, you know, how do I own those things?
Yeah.
And for me, that's just a fascinating tension, because that to me is where this work needs to get to in order to change things.
It's a huge thing. Thank you for bringing that up and telling me a little of your personal experience. Yeah, beauty is such a... I'm going to go to your question, but I'm just moved by the story. The sense of one's beauty has an enormous impact on the person's esteem, obviously. But if one feels beautiful, they express themselves more. They let their intelligence come out. Their eye-hand coordination changes. Their willingness to talk, their willingness to socialize. It's an experience of oneself that has enormous implications for whether you come out in the world as yourself, as even with your intelligence or your ideas or your creativity. It's an enormous thing. Just want to say that. Because some people think, well, that's just beauty. Beauty's, you know, whatever. Beauty's inside. And it won't only work that way. You can't bypass. Then we don't witness. Then we don't learn. Anyway, I want to tell you stories about that, but I want to answer your question. Storytelling is really helpful for people to hear stories if they can, maybe if they can't tell their own in the organization, to hear stories and see if they resonate. So if there are stories of what people experience in the organization that can be offered, read, spoken, that could be really helpful. I never thought of this particular way of telling stories, but it just occurs to me in the moment. In Japan, there are people given the label, and I don't remember the word. I want to say like kabushu or something, but that's 100% wrong. But I have to look it up. My English brain mind doesn't remember the word. But what these people's job is to remember what happened during the atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And they remember it because eventually everybody will be gone and they won't be to tell the stories. So it's their job. So I get to know somebody's story. One person's. And then I am part of a library of people who know these stories. And then I go to the schools and other institutions, and I might even tell the story first person. My name is so-and-so. And what an amazing dedication, so that the memory is held, and then nobody has to out themselves in the organization, but with the living story impacts people. Just like I started to tell some of those different pieces before, I shy away from it because I'm like, okay, I don't know. I'm not with people to know whether they're doing okay, whether they're offended, whether this is bringing up things. But if we're in a room and people could just feel those things, that's very moving.
Thank you for joining us on the Being Luminary podcast, where again we featured an episode from our November 2023 summit. I hope that it offered you some valuable insights and some inspiration. Our special series is continuing on next week, where we're going to be bringing you another of these conversations, which highlights a really interesting set of perspectives and innovative approaches to leadership. Don't miss the next episode. I look forward to seeing you then. This episode was presented by me, Angie Brown. Original music is by Martin Ostwick. The series is edited by Big Tent Media and produced by Emily Crosby Media.